So I think probably one of the biggest ideas that has been inherent in my practice for a long time, although I didn't use a specific name for it, was the low time preference thinking. So in my business with primary care, I'm taking care of infants to the elderly, and I'm thinking about the longevity of their life, you know, the health of their life. And it's not just how long can they live, but how long can they live healthy? So we call it the health span. So we want as many years as we're going to have to be high functioning years. And that's an investment where we have to make decisions now that will benefit us in the future. But sometimes those decisions aren't always the funnest decisions. I would argue that in the long run they are, but you've got to think in the long term.
Welcome to the Business Bitcoinization Show, the show dedicated to helping you enrich your life and grow your business with Bitcoin, the hardest money on planet Earth. I'm your host, Josh Friedemann, and our guest today is Dr. Mark McCall, who is the founder of Pillar Primary Care, which is a direct primary care practice in the Knoxville area. Today, we're going to be talking about how he's incorporating Bitcoin into his business, as well as the four pillars of health. Of course, before we get to our interview with Mark, we do have this week's Bitcoin Meetup Spotlight, and this week is the Knoxville Bitcoin Network. The Knoxville Bitcoin Network aims to be a place where those who are interested in Bitcoin can share their ideas with others. Bitcoin is still a taboo topic in many places, or at least is still widely misunderstood. They hope to not only further educate each other and anyone else who decides to come to their meetups, but to advocate for local Bitcoin adoption in businesses. On top of their meetups, they aim to provide a network for each other by providing a specialization of knowledge and talents. You can follow them on Twitter at KnoxvilleBTC or check out what they're doing next on Meetup. Both those links are down in the show notes below, along with a link to the Oshi app, which you can use to find a Bitcoin meetup near you. Now, we're going to get to our interview with Mark right after this. Business owners, unlock the benefits Bitcoin has to offer your business with the Bitcoin for Business Quick Start Guide. This 27-page guide highlights the 6 ways you can grow your business with Bitcoin. Check it out in the show notes. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I like to start off every single interview with a few questions that help us to get to know you a little bit better and give us some insight for our own lives. Are you ready for these?
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Question number one is this: when and how did you first learn about Bitcoin?
So I was thinking back on this is I remember seeing headlines about Bitcoin, I think topping $200 or so, I think probably 2013, something like that. And not thinking too much about it, just thought, oh, that's interesting. You know, I didn't even know the term magic internet money back then, but that's certainly what I would have thought about. And then again, when it was near like 20,000 in 2017 and really not thinking too hard about it at that point, or maybe even thinking maybe I missed the boat a little bit, but I was sort of in the traditional sort of investing realm, and I was thinking about, like, you know, what mutual fund am I rotating into, what ETF, you know, so what sort of balanced portfolio am I going to be looking at from that type of thing. But it wasn't really until 2020. It was the post-COVID, and it was sort of the reopening of COVID. I was sitting around. I've got a group of guys that I've been meeting with for probably about 15 years. We do a breakfast Bible study once a week, and so we were talking about Bitcoin, and one of the guys brought it up, and I had, honestly had never thought much about it, and just it was one of those cryptocurrencies. But we started talking about it, and I remember like thinking, well, that's really interesting. That may be something I want to investigate a little bit. And so I remember that night I texted him. I was like, well, how do I know Bitcoin's the one? Like, how many other options are there? And he's like, 10,000 or so. And I'm like, oh my goodness, how in the world am I going to do that? So it just started me down the rabbit hole of the conversation of thinking about, like, how do I get into this? What's the interest here? And really thinking about it as looking for, you know, as COVID was reopening, looking for something that maybe was a little bit higher risk, but then also might be higher reward. So I was looking for something in that allocation because it felt like a time where risk on was going to be, like, it was going to be a good move. And so I was looking for that. And the thing that I love about Bitcoin is that the more I investigated, the more I thought, yeah, this is a high reward. But the more you learn, it's like it's actually lower risk and it's lower risk and it's lower risk. And it kind of moves down that portfolio. So it becomes like your lowest risk asset, not your highest risk, but still retains that high reward. And that's just it's kind of been captivating my thoughts for the last 4 years. It's been an awesome journey.
Yep, certainly a unique asset. Question number two is this: what's an insight or fact about Bitcoin that you wish everyone understood?
Yeah, so I think the thing that it taught me more so about a fact about it, there's a lot of amazing facts about Bitcoin, but I think the aspect that it taught me, the principle it taught me, is that volatility and risk are really different. They're not the same thing. And so for most of my investing or saving, I've thought a lot about volatility equals risk. And if I was risk averse, then I had to be volatility averse, and you know, vice versa as well. But what I've come to realize is that they're completely different, you know, sort of topics on the asset that you're thinking about. So risk really is that kind of the risk of loss, or that the probability of loss over a given time period. Well, volatility is the path you're going to take. And so I've started thinking about it a little bit like a roller coaster. So, you know, as you're lining up for a roller coaster, you see, you know, people lining up in the cars, and then 5 minutes later, you hear all the hollers and the yells and all the thrills, but the same people are just getting off the car basically at the entrance. And you realize after you watch this cycle over and over that the risk is close to zero. I mean, the machine may break and other sorts of stuff, but the path is not uncertain. So you know exactly where the end is. And while there's a lot of volatility along the way, and part of that is what makes it fun as well. And I think that's really my analogy for Bitcoin. Of course, we've seen the memes where, you know, the Bitcoin roller coaster of the little coin going up or going down, depending on the market cycle. But it's like you really know with high probability what the end is going to be. You don't know the specific number, of course, but you see these cycle patterns, you see the adoption, you realize there's no better asset to hold. And you know that people are just going to continue to adopt it. So the risk becomes less and less, while the volatility, you know, you can kind of shrug off and sort of enjoy the ride and take the opportunities. And so I think that's just a big principle people need to realize, because in most of the things that we want to buy and hold, we think of volatility and risk as being the same. Like, oh, this is high volatility. This is a collector's item. Who knows if it's still going to be a collector's item next week? You know, need to trade it now, need to move it now. And you don't really have to do that with Bitcoin. You can just buy it and hold it, and you know the risk is pretty low.
Question number three, what's the Bitcoin resource you most recommend to other people?
So I'm actually, I listen to a ton of podcasts. I mean, so whether I'm mowing or driving, that's usually what I do. So Preston Fish's podcast is obviously one of my favorites. And I think his episode with Jesse Myers when he was still Croesus, you know, that one of that, this first episodes was probably like, that was just a light bulb moment for me. And I remember I was listening to it on the way to my Bible study breakfast, and I was sitting there thinking about trading altcoins, you know, and it's like so many people do early on. And I just hear that, and I hear him talking about his thesis on the value of Bitcoin, and I just remember thinking, this is foolish to try and do anything other than to hold it. So I recommend Preston a lot. I just think he covers a wide, diverse topics, you know, and podcasts are usually my go-to.
And I feel like he can talk really well to a more traditional audience as well. Right. So there's a lot of benefit there. So question number four, beyond Bitcoin, what is a resource, tool, or idea that's been helpful to you or your business recently?
So I think probably one of the biggest ideas that has been inherent in my practice for a long time, although I didn't use a specific name for it, was the low time preference thinking. So in my business with primary care, I'm taking care of infants to the elderly, and I'm thinking about the longevity of their life, you know, the health of their life. And it's not just how long can they live, but how long can they live healthy? So we call it the health span. So we want as many years as we're going to have to be high functioning years. And that's an investment where we have to make decisions now that will benefit us in the future. But sometimes those decisions aren't always the funnest decisions. I would argue that in the long run, they are. But you've got to think in the long term. And so there's a lot of that is that low time preference thinking that is just a huge benefit for my practice. And in the way we address problems, the way we address our sort of lifestyle choices with nutrition and exercise, and thinking about don't just think about what right now is. Think about what we want to do next week, next month, and in the years to come. And so that low time preference thinking. So I've written a lot about that. I write a newsletter once a month to my practice. And that was actually the last big newsletter I wrote, was thinking about that. And I got a lot of great feedback talking to patients about adjusting that time frame and thinking about their future goals.
That's great. Now we have question number five. We call it our arbitrary but insightful question. And it's this: as a general life principle, is it better to ask why or why not?
Yeah, so I feel like maybe a lot of your guests, I'm going to hedge on this one a little bit. But as I was thinking through there, you know, it's like, which one do you pick? I realized that for most of my life, most of my education, the why question has got me where I am. It's how I got through school. It's how I learned things. You're asking why. you want to dig deeper on a subject. You want to know as much as there is to know about a subject on these types of things. And so thinking about that has really driven me in sort of maybe the skill of the practice or the skill of my job and so forth. But then the entrepreneurial side of things, starting a new business 8 years ago and running my own practice, that really was the why not. Like, why do I have to stay in this kind of the old system? Why not change into something different? Why not make something that nobody around here has done before? You know, I see people do it, you know, physicians in other communities do it, and I've talked with them, why can't I do that? And so asking that why not question is really sort of the second stage of sort of my career moving forward. So it's hard for me to say which one's like the most important, but that I would say both of those in two different stages.
Today's episode of Business Bitcoinization is proudly brought to you by Velus Commerce, where the future of business technology meets Bitcoin. As we journey through the era of Bitcoin and its transformational impact on businesses, there's one name that stands out: Velus Commerce. Whether you're looking to build a cutting-edge website, a seamless mobile app, or custom software, Velus is your go-to team. They've been diving deep into the world of Bitcoin since 2014, making them one of the most experienced groups for integrating Bitcoin and Lightning payments into a variety of digital platforms. But here's what truly sets them apart. Velus Commerce doesn't just build. They bring a wealth of knowledge to ensure your project's success from day one. Their team understands the nuances of Bitcoin, ensuring that your business stays ahead of the curve. And for all business Bitcoinization listeners out there, Velus Commerce is offering a free consultation to kickstart your project the right way. So if you're ready to future-proof your business in the coming age of hyper-Bitcoinization, head over to veluscommerce.com or reach out on Twitter at veluscommerce. Let's make sure your business thrives in the Bitcoin era. If you are hit by a bus right now, could your family access your Bitcoin? When's the right time to stop hodling and use Bitcoin to impact your family's lives, not just yours? What if Bitcoin doesn't reach the value you expect, or it takes longer to reach that value? Do you have a plan? Do you have the proper trust structure to avoid probate, maintain your privacy, and minimize taxes? Do you want to avoid taxes to stack more sats or leverage your stack without selling? Should you add Bitcoin to your business's balance sheet? Are you truly confident in your self-custody setup? If any of those questions made you stop and think, you probably realize that simply buying and holding Bitcoin is not a complete financial plan. That's where Strong Wealth comes in. Orange-pilled advisors blending traditional financial planning with deep Bitcoin expertise, giving you the best of both worlds, so you can sleep peacefully knowing you're making the right moves for your family no matter what happens. Schedule a free call at strongwealth.net. That's strongwealth.net. Strong Wealth, wealth management for Bitcoiners by Bitcoiners. So, Mark, we're here today to talk about your business pillar, Primary Care. I'd love for you to share with us a little bit about your business, as well as if you have, because I don't know the answer to this yet, but whether or not you have begun to incorporate Bitcoin in your business in one way or another.
So my practice, Pillar Primary Care, I started it 8 years ago, and it was actually started by a different name at that time, but it started as a pilot program within a larger medical practice that I was part of. And it was a traditional sort of insurance-based practice. You start early in the day, and you just see, it seems like 1,000 people sometimes. You've got to move faster. You've got to move quicker. The traditional grind of a medical practice sometimes is what we say. And I was really kind of drowning in that. It turns out like the average visit in the United States an adult visit, an adult patient coming in, is about 8 minutes long. And I was just a really bad 8 minute doctor. I couldn't do that very well. I had too many things I wanted to talk about. I mean, you know, the root word for doctor, docer, often means teacher. So like, how can I teach in 8 minutes? I mean, you just can't do much. And so I was just getting frustrated with those time pressures and those financial pressures. And so I went to my partners and said, hey, we've got to develop a better way. So I kind of came up with a business model and a plan that was a membership based model. And it's now known within the country is sort of we've adopted this model as direct primary care. So what we do is it's a month-to-month membership basis. So I canceled all my insurance contracts. I didn't have any contracts with any insurance payers at all. And I just work directly for my patients. And my patients pay the practice a monthly membership. So there's no long-term contracts. There's nothing more than a 30-day contract. So but the idea behind it is I wanted to bring time as an aspect to be able to work with my patients. So I felt like good healthcare started with a good conversation. So I needed to bring a way to provide that good conversation. And I couldn't do it in 8 minutes. And, you know, most of the day, my nurse spent defending me against phone calls, or we didn't have very many emails or text messages back in the day, but just defending from questions that patients would have, like calling into the practice and having these complaints, because I couldn't handle that and see all my patients and do all the other paperwork all in the same day and even hope to make it home for dinner. So like her job was to defend me from those things. And I just felt this is such a broken system. Like, why can't I just talk to my patient and solve the problem? It seems like it makes sense. And so there are a lot of financial incentives that force us against that for telehealth and other sorts of things that just really weren't a part of the practice. And so abstracting myself out of that, we developed this model where I get just a month-to-month membership. Patients have unlimited access to me, basically. So sometimes I fly on an airplane and they can't call me. But, you know, basically it's unlimited access where all the visits are covered. There's no copays for any visits. Everybody has my cell phone number. Everybody has my email. And literally, I can talk to any of my patients, you know, any day they need to. And I can see pretty much anybody on any day. You know, I have a regular work schedule and all that sort of stuff. But if a patient has, like, just recently, I had a patient with a bee sting on her face. And so she texted me, let me know. She sent me some pictures of it, what's going on. We followed up since then. I've seen her in person, but we've also done things remotely, and we can just manage the whole process just in whatever manner we need to. We don't have to worry about, you know, walking around with a clipboard and filling out like a code sheet for the insurance to make sure that we get the appropriate reimbursement. Oh, did you do this? Did you do that? And we'll check off these boxes. We can just say, what does it make sense for us to take care of this patient? So, you know, most of the memberships are about $79 a month, so it's a pretty accessible amount. And it also allows me to keep my membership panel pretty small. So I have about 600 patients, whereas in the old practice, it took about 6,000 patients to kind of run the same process. And so with that, I kind of know all my patients now. I'm never like, I used to, you know, meet somebody in the grocery store and they start talking about them and I realize they're one of my patients, but I didn't remember them. I might remember like a problem or a lab value because I remember those aspects of things, but I was missing that relational aspect of things. And so I needed to pull out and find a different way to create a practice. And so now I know all of them first name basis. I get invited to things in their family that are going on or get invited to the bedside when they need it. So these types of things are just, it's a totally different style of practice for me. Along with that, we're able to kind of reduce the cost of some of the normal things. So most labs are dirt cheap. You know, a lipid, you know, test, a cholesterol panel might be $2. And so we don't really need insurance to like cover a $2 cost. When it's cheaper than a cup of coffee, you don't need health insurance to pay for that. So I actually just include that as part of membership. So we don't charge for a lot of labs. We just, if somebody needs a lipid panel, we give it to them several times for free. And if they need it extra, we just cover their costs. And that's kind of what we do with all of our labs. We do that with some medications that we dispense as well. So if they need an antibiotic, then we just cover the cost on that. So whatever I'm buying for wholesale, I basically can turn it around and give it to them for the same thing. So we're bringing value, sort of reduced cost for this and better access. I think we can manage about 80 or 90% of kind of the common healthcare problems in the primary care setting. And that allows us to kind of manage most of that in-house. And so we don't have to send a lot of people out for referrals. We're not sending people out to lots of specialists. Now, we do when we need to, but it allows us to do so much more now because every visit's longer. I can see them as many times as I need to. And that's just been such a blessing to me being able to run this. Now, I have a special bent as well as far as thinking about sort of lifestyle factors. And so the name Pillar comes from thinking about the four pillars of good health. We think about nutrition and exercise and sleep and managing our stress or really pursuing peace and kind of the biblical term of shalom is how do we bring that peace to somebody's life where maybe the circumstances aren't great. We can't always change the circumstances, but we might still have peace as well. So we teach a lot of nutrition. I have a dietitian on staff. I have a health coach on staff. I have a certified personal trainer on staff. And so all of my patients that come through get to see those ladies as well. So they get to meet with our experts and develop a plan that's specific to them. Now, I have my thoughts on nutrition and things like that, but develop a plan that's specific to them that allows them to achieve their goals. So we do a lot of reversing diabetes. We do a lot of weight loss because we can reverse insulin resistance. We do a lot of high blood pressure or cholesterol management through lifestyle changes alone. And, you know, when we address these things, when we think long term, it's really very effective, you know, and so that the amount of medications and surgeries and interventions tend to be less. We still use them. I don't think they're wrong in any way, but we can choose well and then therefore maybe not have to do some of these other avenues as well.
There are a handful of follow-up questions I want to ask. One thing that would still be good to hear about is, I know you're a Bitcoiner. Have you figured out ways to incorporate it? Is there a desire? Do you find that your clients are Bitcoiners themselves? Or is it just one of those things where talking about low time preference and things like that, you're beginning to incorporate some of those principles into your practice, but you haven't really done anything as far as bringing Bitcoin into the business yet?
So, yeah. So since I get paid directly by patients, you know, I've asked for, you know, at various times talked about accepting Bitcoin. I've had one or two patients pay me that way, not very many. And I honestly don't begrudge that and get rid of the fiat and hold on to your Bitcoin. Sure. I can see that. So, but so we've been talking about it for several years. I do offer a discount. So I offer a 10% discount if somebody pays in Bitcoin. And again, I think it more is a conversation starter. I've got a couple kind of Bitcoin maxis within the practice, and they're always fine because one of them in particular, every time he emails me about some health concern, he always gives me the block height. And so I send it back to him as the block height. So we, you know, happy block, you know, 839, 461 or whatever it is, you know, so we always kind of talk back and forth in that regard. So it's been a lot of fun to kind of bring that up and kind of help to sort of incorporate that as well. You know, so as far as finances, you know, kind of running the practice on a Bitcoin standard, we're certainly moving in that. I've got a lot of kind of, you know, US dollar liabilities. And so I've got to be careful with that sort of cash management. But definitely Bitcoin sort of lowers the cost of everything in the long run. And that's been a kind of a wonderful addition.
And different businesses have different considerations. So by no means do I expect everyone that I interview to be operating on a Bitcoin standard. Most people aren't. And there are a lot of hoops you have to jump through, hurdles you have to jump over to get to that full Bitcoin standard. I think it's cool that you have Bitcoiners that you're serving right now. Yeah. One of the other things that I was curious about is you mentioned the pillars that your business is built on. I may have missed it if you summarize those four pillars, but I'm wondering if you could bring those up again and then also share about maybe one or two things that people listening to this podcast right now can be thinking about in each of those areas that are kind of like the large catch-alls that you would recommend to people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so the four pillars are nutrition, exercise, sleep, and stress. And so addressing them, they're a lot like pillars of a chair, or legs on a chair, or pillars of a foundation. And so the idea is, like, if we work on those things and we take them seriously and we choose intentionally in those four areas, it becomes a spiral of better health. So if we eat well, it makes exercise easier. Our body's physically capable of exercise. And if we're exercising well, then we can sleep better and deeper. And that deeper sleep is restorative. There are things happen in the brain chemistry that promote good mental and spiritual health that only happen during sleep. I mean, there's stuff that physiologically occurs. It's not just dead time. It's actually the brain does some amazing things that allow you to be a healthier human, you know, the next day. And so then if you're eating, you know, if you're kind of managing your stress better, you feel emotionally stable, then perhaps you're not eating as a reward. You're not looking for a dopamine surge. And so you have this spiral of better health versus the spiral of worse health, which is kind of tends to where we see bad diets and lead to not being able to exercise, leads to poor sleep, and leads to hard emotional health and reward ourselves with food again. So when I think about these things, you know, we kind of usually start at the beginning and work through, but we try and adapt the four pillars to the individual. So sometimes sleep is a critical element, you know, sometimes stress is, most often food is the one that we can intervene on. Everybody eats pretty much every day. And so with that, you get an opportunity to decide what to eat. Most people have a choice. They don't usually have a full choice. They don't have everything option to them, but they do usually have choices. And so you start to make inroads. And so from a nutritional standpoint, you know, the base of that, I'm a low carb sort of guy. So I really work on insulin resistance, reducing to an appropriately low enough carbohydrate. So it's not necessarily always keto. It's not always carnivore. It's low enough. It's what does it take to be low enough? But I'm also a real food sort of guy. So in the sense, like, I want people to eat real food, not fake stuff. You know, I want, like, real food tends to be much healthier for you than any sort of processed food. So a real food, a whole food, a low enough carbohydrate, high enough protein, and fueled by fat diet is the principles there. So just, you know, start off by eating, you know, if it's got, you know, if your food has more than three ingredients in it, question whether or not it's real food. Ask the question, if sugar is my quick fuel, am I going to do something that requires quick fuel today? If not, if you're not doing sprint exercises or a long hike, you probably don't need that sugar. Maybe think about going without it. You know, sugar is the only macronutrient that the body is not required to eat. So if you stop eating protein, you die. If you stop eating fat, you die. Just like if you stop breathing oxygen or drinking water, you die. If you stop eating carbohydrates, if you're genetically typical, nothing happens to you. Like you're totally fine to do those sorts of things. So the question becomes, how many carbohydrates should I eat? What's wise for me to eat? What's good for me? So in the realm of exercise, probably the simplest thing that we try and get people to do is to start moving. But I always do that after their carbohydrates are low enough. Because if you're in a high carbohydrate state, that means your insulin is high as well. And that means you're in a storage state, which means the fuel that's going in the body is being stored. I mean, think about pumping gas into your gas tank in your car, but it can never make it to the engine. You can't drive anywhere. It doesn't matter how many people berate you for not driving. You know, you're not going to go anywhere, right? And so you need to be able to take that fuel and put it into the engine. And as long as insulin's high, you're not going to do that. So if you lower the carbohydrates, you lower the insulin, then you release fuel. Usually about 2 to 3 weeks into a low enough carbohydrate diet, people start feeling so energetic, they can't really sit down. So at the end of the day, they're not sitting down, putting their feet up. They're going for an extra walk, especially when the spring comes around and the weather's as good as it is here. They get out. And so then at night for the sleep, sort of the primary thing that I always tell people is sleep in the cold, the quiet, and the dark. You know, it likes to be on a schedule. It needs to be a little bit colder than you think. And then turn off the lights, turn off the noise. Your body doesn't really need those distractions. And, you know, and that also means sometimes if the bedroom environment's not quiet, if maybe your bedmate's snoring, or if you're snoring, maybe you need to get that looked at because that's a big deal. And then as far as peace goes, just understand that stress isn't a bad thing. Too much stress can be a bad thing. You really want to manage that stress. So if you're going to an environment where you have higher stress, say you've got some, like especially teenagers, like high school can be really stressful. You need some moments to be able to decouple from that. And you need to be able to learn a skill set to manage that stress. There are certain things that we can do, certain ways we can think about things, certain techniques, just like learning soccer, you know, learning how to kick or to run or to dribble. It's like learning any sport. You can learn to manage stress as well. And so sit down and talk with somebody and spend a lot of time talking with adults that have never thought about how to manage stress, never thought about a way to kind of step back and realize I don't have to carry every burden every minute, that I can choose the burden that I carry and move forward with. And in doing so, you can manage that stress. And it's not ignoring the problems. It's just deciding for this moment what to do. And then we reiterate that. So in my practice, I see people honestly as often as they want to, but at least every 3 months. And we do blood work, a fasted blood work at each of those times. And then we sit down and say, how are we doing on these four pillars? Let's reiterate. What's the next step? Let's do it again. See you in 3 months. And we kind of keep moving that spiral up until we're reducing medicine, sleeping better, feeling better, you know, exercising more, able to accomplish those goals, losing weight, those types of things.
Excellent. That's a great summary. I appreciate that. One of the other things that you had mentioned earlier is reversing diabetes. I was curious, like, I feel like in the keto carnivore world, that's something that's talked about a good bit. Is that something that is controversial to say in, let's say, a traditional medical context or conventional medical context?
Yeah. So conventionally, you know, it's kind of funny you use the word traditional because, you know, in all of human history, doctors and patients have worked directly together. So that's the traditional model. It's not until that third party payer got in that that's like what we consider traditional models. But yes, it is controversial to in some respects, although there's a lot of things that are coming around to that because you just see it work. You see it happen. And so, you know, in the literature, you can look and find a couple different sort of tried and true sort of evidence-based approaches to reversing diabetes. And some of these, I mean, things like gastric bypass surgery has a pretty high effective rate. You know, you can do a very low calorie diet. So just eat less, like 100,000 calories a day. I would say that both of those are tough. You know, those can be really tough. And so they're really just restricting those things. In the literature now, especially with companies like Virta Health, that's been doing a ton of research in this, you see things like a low carbohydrate approach, and even the American Diabetes Association kind of will mention that a low carbohydrate approach is something worthwhile to consider. You know, they kind of give it a soft recommendation, or at least, you know, what they say, the Overton window is moving to actually include a low enough carbohydrate diet to reverse diabetes. In my practice, you know, I remember in medical school, one of my classmates, an older classmate, friend of mine, he gave me a book that kind of talked about it in probably my second year of medical school. And I'm just like, this makes so much sense. And then as I went through biochemistry class and nutrition, I'm like, well, of course it makes so much sense. Look at all the biochemical pathways. It must work. And so then started to incorporate it in my own life in various degrees and found that it was incredibly helpful for my own health. I didn't have diabetes, thankfully, but I certainly had a lot of insulin resistance. And so a lot of that's reversed and it's non-existence. But now being able to reverse that diabetes and get people off medicines and, you know, improve their overall health. It's just, that's an amazingly rewarding venture for folks to undertake.
So Veronica Max was a guest I had on back in the fall, and she does she has a similar model of care as Pillar. I asked her a question. I don't think it was formulated quite as well as what I hope to formulate to you now.
Yeah.
But I'm curious to know, especially in light of this thing about diabetes and whether or not conventional medicine thinks it's reversible or not, what is something that people do today that you think in the future, whether it's 5, 10, 20 years from now, that people will look back on and say, I can't believe that we did that? And what is something that you feel like is on the fringes of medical literature, just kind of the fringes of cultural belief that you feel like will be common practice in the future as far as health goes?
So, I mean, I'd say on the fringes, like one of my favorite tools is the continuous glucose monitor. So Dexcom and Freestyle Libre are the two that are out there. I use the Freestyle Libre 3 mostly because it's the least expensive of the two. A lot of insurances don't cover it, but cash price is pretty reasonable. But the ability to know yourself, the ability to self-measure. And so, honestly, there was a period of time where I had a lot of new patients that would come from, honestly, some of the local endocrinology practices because they wouldn't prescribe them. And I just couldn't figure out why. It's like not prescribing, like if I had to prescribe a blood pressure monitor for somebody so they can know what their blood pressure is, or a scale so they can know how much they weigh. I mean, like, why not? Like, if they should be over the counter. Thankfully, they're coming over the counter. Dexcom's coming out with one soon that's going to be over the counter, which hopefully will be cheap or cheap enough, and it'll be great. But that's sort of been on the fringe, and over the last 3 or 4 years, it's really coming to the forefront. And more monitoring systems like that, where you're able to take a look and assess, like, what is this data coming out of my own body? What is my own body doing that allows me to make an intellectual change? So I don't have to respond to how I feel, or maybe some sort of standard that's sort of outside myself, or some sort of program, but that I could actually say, well, this is what my insulin is, or this is what my glucose is, and now I can change my behavior. Because when my first continuous glucose monitor that I bought for the practice was in 2014, and I remember it very vividly. I would loan it out 1 week at a time. Patients would come back. They had a little monitor that showed the daily graph. It was a 24-hour scrolling. They had no ability to download or anything else. And I thought that they would come back and I would plug it into the computer and I'd print out these beautiful reports. And I thought that was going to be their epiphany moment. And it turns out they didn't need any of that. So they'd come back in and say, look right here. Like, I took a picture of it on my phone. See with this? This is when I eat, you know, XYZ. This is why I eat pancakes. This is why I eat an apple and so forth. And I saw, like, this is how it affected me. And every time it went up, my sugar was going up. I knew I must be in storage mode. And if I don't want that to happen, I need to not let my sugar go up and make those changes. And I think tools like that are coming out. A continuous insulin monitor would be amazing. There's continuous ketone monitors that are coming out. So I think that technology, that self-evaluation technology, is really on the fringes. As far as kind of what's looked back on and thought about, like, we can't believe we didn't use it now. It's hard to say. I mean, I think I routinely spend... at a lot of my visits when I'm reviewing labs, I routinely talk patients through what, you know, the reference ranges. When you look on a lab sheet, you'll see off to the side sort of this range, a low and a high range. And some of those are population-based studies, but a lot of those are actually guideline-based. They're not like, it's not your population, it's not your bell curve. And it's actually somebody said, this is a good idea. So for instance, the LDL cholesterol, you know, 0 to 99 is listed on my lab sheet is what's normal. And that's just somebody's idea of a good, you know, somebody's thought is a good idea. It's not necessarily what everybody needs to shoot for. And talk about a can of worms. Where does your LDL cholesterol need to be? That's not what this show's for. But, you know, that I think things like that where people are going to be more in control of where do I want it to be and why. If I have a low LDL cholesterol, what does that mean for my cardiovascular risk, for my infection risk, for my dementia risk? If I have a high one, what does that mean? And what do I want to do? Like, where should I be? What's best for me? Here's the data. And I think hopefully we'll come to a forefront where we say that we'll stop telling patients what to do and we'll start having a conversation with them and trying just to be wise counselors and wise advocates for their own decision-making and let them choose where they want to be. You know, these are the data that I see it. Choose your outcome, choose your decision, choose your activity. And I think that's something that we'll look back on and say, I can't believe we tried to tell them what to do.
I think that's an excellent place to close the interview for now. But of course, before we finally finish up the interview, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to share with people or places you'd like for listeners to go to keep up with what you're doing at Pillar?
Thank you so much. I mean, I think pillarpc.com is the website. So if you're interested in that, I would just encourage everybody to, if you're interested in a practice like mine, they're all over the country. And so direct primary care is sort of the model name. And the beautiful thing about it is they are as variable as the physicians that are running them. And so every town has its own flavor. Every practice has its own flavor. So there's lots of places you can go look. So there's a company called Atlas MD, which is a kind of a thought leader within the direct primary care field that you can go look. They have a map to carry that. And there's something called dpcfrontier.com. They have a mapper. So if you're interested in a program working with a physician kind of directly for your own needs, go look us up, you know, and everybody can find my email address on our website. So if you want me to help you find something, just send me an email. I'll do whatever I can for you.
Perfect. Mark, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Glad being here, Josh. Thank you.
Well, friends, it's a wrap. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Business Bitcoinization Show. If you want to reach out to either me or Mark, you can find those links down in the show notes. And if you're interested in direct primary care for you or your family, be sure to check out what's available in your area. As always, keep building, keep growing, and until next time, keep living and leading well.